Well, as I said before we began our readings, you can't go any deeper into the mysteries of God and into the Christian faith than we are this morning. And I've been doing this a long time. This is, maybe my 35th or 36th Lent or time of preaching through the Passion. And never once have I felt adequate before these texts. I don't know how anyone ever does feel adequate before these texts. And obviously there's 100 directions we could go in these texts, but what I've decided to do this morning is to treat these readings as kind of the last part of Lent and a transition into Holy Week. So in this Lent, I didn't necessarily plan it this way, but this Lent has really ended up being kind of a series on spiritual formation or discipleship or being an apprentice to Jesus or something like that. We have had an emphasis on solitude and silence as kind of disciplines of abstinence, and then of worship and study as disciplines of engagement. And so this morning is, in the calendar, kind of a bittersweet moment where there's the celebration of the parade, and then we now start moving towards Maundy Thursday and Good Friday and Holy Saturday, and then Easter. So what's the backstory here? What is really going on in the story behind these texts? And it's simply this, it's the problem of sin. Now, I've said before, and so I need to remind you, that sin is not the only thing going on in God's mind. That, remember, I've said that our story doesn't start with the fall. And it's not as if the, quote, Christian religion only exists with reference to the fall. But before the fall, there was creation, and everything was good. But before creation, there existed this Trinitarian God, this one God who exists in three persons. So if you have a Trinity, you have personhood. And if you have personhood, you have intentionality. And then you have that personhood and that intentionality going on in the community of this Trinity. They create. But they create for a purpose. That's the backstory here. So whenever you hear this amazing language from Isaiah of him being bruised for our iniquities, you know, beaten for our transgressions, hear that kind of language that we'll get to in a moment. Remember that is not with reference merely to the fact that God's like really angry and he somehow needs to be appeased, as if that's the whole story. It's not the whole story. And you will never get to where you want to go as an apprentice of Jesus if you think that's the main part of the story. The main part of the story is, why did God create us? And sin is, in one sort of simple way to talk about it, is simply a departure from those intentions. So this is something that needs to be talked about today. And I'm aware, you know, I'm all over America doing various things, you know, most weeks. And so I hear the conversations that are going on both inside and outside of the church. And I'm aware that this is not an easy thing to talk about today. I mean, on the one hand, there's kind of a revival within the church of a kind of a neo-Calvinism that wants to make sure that we don't lose sight of the fact that God is rightfully angry, that he is rightfully has the right to judge sin, and that God in his holiness, that there's some sort of appeasement is necessary. I get it. I mean, that is ancient Christian thought. That was going on even before, you can find threads of it even before the Reformation. But before the Reformation and after the Reformation, there's lots of other thoughts that sort of fill in what is atonement. And there's a great mystery there. And what I want us to do is to not stop talking about it, either because you can't quite be, you know, a neo-Calvinist, you know, and nor can you be what people would call liberals, like, you know, you don't want to go there. And maybe you can't decide, you know, am I supposed to see the love of God through the justice of God, and that's what's primary in God? Or am I supposed to see the justice of God through the love of God, and that's what's primary in God? And I just want to say to you this morning, you don't have to choose. That is a false dualism. It's a false dichotomy. You don't have to make that kind of choice. And I'm going to tell you why in a moment. So we can't back off from sin. We can't not talk about it. There is a mystery to it. But mystery doesn't mean we can't talk about it or that we can't enter into it. Let me show you what I mean. Other than the doctor or two or medical professional who might be in this room, probably none of you can give me a very quick explanation of why it is that the acid and bile in your stomach does not eat your stomach. It eats beef. When you eat chicken or fish, it messes with it. Why doesn't it mess with the meat that is your stomach? I don't know. But it doesn't keep us from eating. At least it doesn't keep me from eating. I don't get how that works. And you talk to any honest doctor and they'll tell you that there are still great mysteries about conception, about gestation, about birth. There are mysteries, but we were all born. So mystery doesn't mean this isn't something that we can ever deal with. Mystery just means there's something there that is bigger than our capacity to talk about it, even bigger than the people who are loudly talking about it today. Now this last part, when we move from the procession to the crucifixion of Jesus, this is not like a bummer or an accident at the end of an otherwise stellar career. Like, oh, what a bummer, Jesus finally got busted. You know, like the authorities finally got him. You know, like this was a Western, you know, like, oh, shoot, the hero just, you know, they finally caught him. It's not that kind of thing. This is actually a planned climax to the story. And that's why I say it's so important that you think of pre-creation divine intentionality. Because this is where the story has always been pointing. It's a divine climax. That's what the text means when it says things like, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. I mean, I can't be the only person in this room who reads that and goes, what the heck? And that's why many people today are running from what is normally meant or thought of as orthodox atonement theory or orthodox doctrines of the atonement. They just simply cannot get their mind wrapped around this. Contemporary society does not allow our minds to easily go there, and so people are wanting to jettison this. So yes, it's stunning. Yes, it's surprising. Yes, it's not what we would have expected, but it was planned. From this divine intention all the way to this divine completion or divine telos. Now, in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah has been saying, hey, God's servant is coming. And he's been saying that this servant will suffer. But in the passage we read today, he now gives us the meaning. What's the reason for this suffering? And he says, here's the meaning, that we all, like sheep, have gone astray, and each of us have turned to our own way. Those are the basic Hebrew words for sin. Those are the basic kind of Jewish ideas for sin, to go your own way, to go astray, to turn away from God. And so the Lord has laid on Jesus the iniquity, which is just another Hebrew word for sin, of us all. And so this is now how you get into this language, that he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. So do you see the logic here? In the earlier chapters of Isaiah, he's been saying this suffering servant is coming. That this servant is coming. And then in the servant song just before this, when he says, and this servant is going to suffer. And now in this part of Isaiah, he's saying that the punishment that brought us peace was on his wounds, was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. So what these stories are telling us this morning, if you take them as a whole, is that Jesus Barabbas, I mean, Jesus was a very common name, like Tom. Lots of people would have been named Jesus. And so the story here is, we are Jesus Barabbas. We get to go free because Jesus died. But you see, freedom is a subtly different, actually it's more than subtle, it's a big difference between freedom and forgiveness. See, if you think the story is just all about forgiveness and your accounts being reconciled with God, sort of like maybe you guys have one of those systems where you get a little message on your phone if you're overdrawn. So you get a little beep, beep from the bank that says, oops, you're overdrawn. And then somebody pays that $30 for you. That's not the point. That's included in the point. It's a very big part of the point, but it can't be reduced to the point. The point is the freedom that you feel afterwards and the freedom that you have to actually go and be according to the divine intention of God. That's the big story. And I think there's a good reason that lots of our culture around us is saying, we just don't get you guys. And I think it's because in some senses, they're like prophets to us, saying there has to be more to this than simply some sort of exchange, some sort of religious exchange where I say a couple of words of penance and then somehow God through Jesus imputes Jesus's righteousness to me. And again, I don't have a beef with that explanation. I'm simply saying it doesn't have the kind of cash that it needs to have if it's only seen with reference to my sins being forgiven. What it has to do with is freedom. Barabbas got to not just live, or excuse me, Barabbas got to not just die, he got to live. So these days, if I'm talking to somebody about their faith and seeing that it's not getting anywhere through the line of questioning that says, if you knew you were going to die tonight, do you know where you would go? You know, when people start rolling their eyes at that kind of stuff, I have in my artillery, you might say, a whole different set of questions that I think are way more provocative and important. And that is, what if you knew you were going to live tomorrow? What if you knew for sure you were going to live tomorrow? And what if you knew for absolute certain that you were going to live next week and next month and next year and for another decade? What if you were going to live another 40 years? You knew that for sure. Whom would you follow? From whom would you learn to do life? Oh, well, I'm not learning to do life. I'm not a follower. I'm a leader. No, everybody's learning to do life from somebody, whether they admit it or not. And see, that order of question gets us back to the divine intention and not simply to the first human fall or our fall away from that. So what's in mind here with atonement is justification. Yes, we are justified through Christ, but also redemption. That is to say, we get relief. Another biblical image for the atonement is salvation, which means that we get rescued. Reconciliation, a relationship brought back together. Pardon, something being forgiven. Moral influence. We sang moral influence songs this morning. I pour contempt on all my pride. That is the moral influence of the cross that sits right at the center of human history. I pour contempt on all my pride. That is an aspect of the atonement. Ransom, somebody paid for us. Christus Victor, that Jesus in his death destroyed, disarmed all the principalities and powers, and that was the beginning of the end. Satisfaction of a debt. Substitution, someone being in our place. See, what I want to say to you this morning is you don't have to try to fit in kind of current arguments. The atonement is big and broad. It's as big and broad as your human need and my human need. And my human need goes beyond mere forgiveness. Forgiveness unto what? Barabbas got to live. What did Barabbas do with his life? He got to live because Jesus died for him. Wonder who he followed. I wonder who was his teacher. I wonder who he apprenticed himself to. See, what I've done, and I think lots of you have, is I've decided to make Jesus my master, and I've apprenticed myself to him so that I actually can pour contempt on all my pride. I can't do that without a teacher. I need somebody to teach me to do that. Because even as we've been saying all Lent, even if I somehow think that I will to do that, my thoughts and feelings, like little lobbyists, are constantly telling me, no, go for your pride. You know, my feeling says, no, I need this. My thoughts say, no, I need this. And so my will is like tumbling around in a dryer, being motorized by my thoughts and feelings. And atonement has to include that, not just forgiveness of our sins. So Matthew then, he carries on this, showing us the meaning of Jesus' death and what he shows us and what he's wanting us to see, and you might not have got it on first seeing it, but what he wants us to see is that the response that happens around Jesus in non-human reality, that is to say, the response of things is a pointer to what a big deal this is. When it says, at the moment that Jesus breathed out his last, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. What do you suppose that meant? That means, O religious system, you are done. And the authority that you hid behind, the veil that there was between God and the people, it's done. The earth shook, the rocks split, tombs broke open. Bodies of holy people were raised to life. They came out of tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, went into the holy city and appeared to many people. How'd you like to have seen that? Frank, what are you doing here? Now, this is all meant to say something really enormous is happening here that makes all of us have to make a choice. So when the centurion and those who were with Jesus and who were guarding him, when they saw the earthquake and all that had happened, see, nobody had repented yet. Nobody had been given to them yet forgiveness of sins. There was just all this stuff happening in the material world. They're terrified and they exclaimed, "Surely he is the Son of God." And that's the decision to which Matthew the evangelist is drawing his readers. It's the ultimate Lenten question. Surely is he the Son of God? Matthew is, after all, an evangelist. He's not a gospel writer in the way that you might think of it. Don't think of him as a literary specialist. He's an evangelist. He has a point of view. He's trying to lead people to something that he knows to be true. Tom Wright, I saw somewhere, I can't remember now, an illustration from him where he pictures rain falling on Jerusalem, but kind of make, but you know, using a mixing metaphors, making Jerusalem almost like a point. He sees rain falling on it, and depending on which side of that point rain hits, if it hits to the east, it falls into the Dead Sea. If it hits to the west of Jerusalem, it goes into the Mediterranean. And this is where Wright sees that this statement of the soldier and this sort of Lenten question for us, this day-to-day, moment-by-moment, we live on this razor's edge. Of, on the one hand, you know, Judas appears in this story just before what we read this morning. And, you know, Judas has remorse. Remorse and anger and recrimination and self-hatred and self-destruction, which leads to death, the Dead Sea. But then you have Peter, and you have repentance, changing his mind, tears, shame in the good sense of shame, the good sense of humility and desire to put to death what was wrong in him, and he finds a way back to life. This is what the story is trying to bring us all to, these kinds of decisions. When you have Christ versus Pilate, as you just heard in the expert reading from our two readers, that's the only time you ever see in the Bible a direct kind of confrontation between these two powers, Caesar and his governor, and Jesus and his father. And again, Matthew knew what he was doing. He was trying to say, as he shows us, how both sides of these come out. With Caesar, you see power, manipulation, aggression, systemic injustice. With Jesus, you see silence, suffering, humility, mercy, and love. You see people despising him, rejecting him. And Matthew is trying to bring us all to this kind of Lenten decision that, yes, Jesus is worth me following. He's not merely a vial of blood because you sinned. That would make your relationship with him utilitarian to the utmost. He is not simply a prescription of blood. He is God, the God who spoke it all into existence and who will bring it to its complete fulfillment, its telos. He is that God. And what these Lenten readings have been trying to do is lift him before us and say, as you pause, as you stop all the activity and you shush yourself and you see it clearly, is he one who you would apprentice yourself to? This is what Paul's asking us to do in the Philippians passage. He's saying Jesus didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life. then died a selfless, obedient death, the worst kind of death, the crucifixion. Now I make him my master, and I say, God, help me to pour contempt upon all my pride, because if I don't, in my relationship with you, I can't have the same mind as Jesus. Because he was acting out of humility. He was acting out of selflessness, obedience. And so Paul's saying, have this same mind that was in Christ, the same mindset, the same worldview, the same notion about what is reality. God intended something. It's going to happen. We find ourselves caught in that story. It lent. We stop. We pause about this. We think about it. And we meditate on what can it mean that it was the Lord's will to crush him? What can it mean that it was the Lord's will to cause his son to suffer? Well, the text itself answers the question when it says, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. So something that was predetermined before there was space and time begins to unfold. It's mysterious. People didn't get it then. People don't get it now. And people way smarter and way godlier than I have tried to think about it and write about this stuff for 2,000 years. But for me, here's my little bit of imagination, then I'm done. I love the really dramatic, sort of tense scene in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 4 and 5. Probably haven't read it for a while, so let me just remind you. In Revelation 5, you know, there's this picture of God on his throne, and he's holding this scroll, and it's sealed with seven seals, and no one can open it. And then John sees someone saying, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed, and he's able to open the scroll and its seven seals. And then it says, then I saw a lamb looking as if he had been slain. He went, the lamb, this slain lamb, goes up to his father. He takes the scroll from the right hand of his father, and all of heaven then exclaims, you are worthy to take the scroll. You are worthy to open its seals because you were slain. It was the Lord's will to bruise him that the will of God would prosper in his hands in a way that it couldn't. In the patriarchs, in the prophets, in John the Baptist, in the apostles, in you and I, the will of God marches forth in human history through his Son. And it's why I put myself in the Son's train. I put myself in his shadow. And I say, I believe you, and I'm apprenticing myself to you, and I'm choosing to learn to do life from you. That apprentice model is really important, because what does every apprentice do? Make mistakes. Every apprentice makes mistakes. And it's so freeing for me to just be an apprentice. I don't have to get it perfect. I don't have to be right all the time, but I am following. And I am trying to do whatever it takes to pour contempt upon my pride so that I can be a part of just taking my little part of being worthy to take up my little role in God. So heaven says, and with your blood you purchase for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise because he was crushed for our iniquities and suffered on our behalf. Well, that's how the story ends for him. The way the story ends for us, Revelation 22:5. And they, meaning us, will rule and reign with him forever and ever in the new heavens and the new earth. As we give ourselves to him as his apprentice, knowing that this story starts in his intention and will be completed as it was intended, we then take our little life and we fit it into that big story and we say, Jesus, I'll follow you into that. Amen.